I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. President Trump tweeted this morning that he has selected Christopher Wray, an official in the Justice Department, to be his nominee for FBI director. This is one day before fired director James Comey testifies before the Senate Intelligence Committee. The New York Times is reporting that Comey told Attorney General Jeff Sessions that he did not want to be alone with the president after claiming that Trump asked him to stop the investigation into former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. The Washington Post is reporting that Daniel Coats, director of national intelligence, told associates that Trump asked him to intervene in the Flynn probe to get Comey to back off. He's testifying today along with other intelligence chiefs. There are also reports that Attorney General Sessions offered to resign. Now, President Trump has defended his use of tweets that have created problems for his administration. Press Secretary Sean Spicer said this yesterday at a White House briefing.
Are President Trump's tweets considered official White House statements?
Well, the president is the president of the United States, so they're considered official statements by the president of the United States.
We asked Ron Elving to join us, senior editor and correspondent for the Washington desk for NPR, joining us from the studios of NPR. And Ron, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you, Marty.
Also with us is Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill. And Reed, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Hey, Marty.
Ron, let me begin with you. What do we know about Christopher Wray? This tweet came earlier this morning.
Christopher Wray was the head of the criminal division at the Justice Department under President George W. Bush, a very important and prominent position. Since then, he has been a white-collar criminal attorney and is probably best known to most of your listeners as the defense attorney for New Jersey Governor Chris Christie in the Bridgegate case.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. What do you make about the timing of this, Reed Wilson? And I know there were several other people that the president wanted to tap to be FBI director. This, of course, a day before Comey's testimony.
Yeah, this Christopher Wray's name was not on the long list of potential nominees to replace Jim Comey. There is, you know, I saw some people tweeting this morning that this is an effort to distract from tomorrow's hearing. And if it is, that's sort of like shooting off a cap gun to try to distract people from a train crash. This is, it's interesting to me, by the way. I'm sitting here refreshing my email, and after the president tweeted this a couple hours ago, there has been no word from the White House officially confirming it or telling anybody about Christopher Wray and about why he is qualified for the job. As Ron said, Wray's got a history in the Justice Department. He is somebody who will be taken seriously, even by Democrats. And it's funny that Wray is involved in one of these sort of stories that's become Washington legend of late, when Jim Comey, Robert Mueller, the then FBI director, who's now the special counsel, threatened to quit. Resign during the Bush administration when the White House wanted to reauthorize some surveillance, NSA surveillance of American citizens. Comey said no, threatened to resign. So did Christopher Wray. So they're all sort of entangled in this one incident that is now becoming famous once again.
Well, you know, Ron, I'm actually looking at my TV while I'm talking to you. Sorry about that. But there is a testimony. We'll hear from Daniel Coats and other intelligence chiefs. They are appearing before the Senate Intelligence Committee. And again, on the heels of this report from the Washington Post, what do you expect this morning?
These two individuals have just as much to say about all of this as anyone else. Dan Coats is the Director of National Intelligence. That is the absolute apogee of our intelligence community. Everyone, in a sense, reports to him. And he, of course, reports to the president. Then you have Admiral Mike Rogers, who is not only the head of the National Security Agency. Now, that's not the same thing as being the National Security Advisor. That's
right.
Someone else. But he does head up that agency, and he is in charge of the U.S. Cyber Command. So these are people with a great deal of interest for this community, and their testimony today has been hugely overshadowed, of course, by the anticipation of Jim Comey's testimony tomorrow. But this, too, is of great importance to the overall relationship between Congress, the president, and the intelligence community.
And if it's true, and I guess it should be said, these were anonymous sources to the Washington Post. Ron, I'll toss this back to you, and Reed, I'd like you to weigh in as well. But let's say it's true. If Trump asked him to intervene in the Flynn probe to get Comey to back off, at what point is that considered intervention or obstruction?
It certainly depends on the language. If the president phrased that as some sort of an order, then we are really seriously into Watergate territory, because ultimately what brought down Richard Nixon was that he tried to stop the investigation into a burglary and a number of other crimes that had been committed by people ultimately connected to his reelection campaign way back in the day. Now, if, on the other hand, they had some sort of a general discussion of the investigation, and the president never actually told these people to call off Jim Comey or to call off the Senate Intelligence Committee or anyone else, then we may be in murkier territory.
Do you think this will come up today, Reed Wilson?
Oh, it'll certainly come up. I'm sitting here watching through the screen as well. And you know, given that Dan Coats, the director of national intelligence, has said that that he was pressured, I mean, you can imagine that Mark Warner, the Democratic vice chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, that'll be probably the first question out of his mouth. So the interesting thing, Ron brought up the Watergate comparison. Richard Nixon asked the CIA to shut down the FBI investigation. He asked one individual to do that. Trump has now brought up this investigation with at least two people, Director of National Intelligence Coates and FBI Director Comey. That's twice as many people to bring up this issue with, and twice as many people who may be involved in a future obstruction case.
Well, let's talk about Attorney General Sessions, and let me play something. This is Sean Spicer answering a question about Trump's confidence in Sessions. This is from yesterday.
How would you describe the president's level of confidence in the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions?
I have not had a discussion with him about that.
Last time you said that, there was a development.
I'm answering a question, which is I have not had that discussion with him.
So you say he has confidence in his Attorney General?
I said I have not had a discussion with him on the question. I don't. If I haven't had a discussion with him about a subject, I tend not to speak about it.
What do you make of that, Ron?
Well, I dropped what it was that I had in my hand at that particular moment of the news conference yesterday, because that is just not the answer. Mm. The answer, if you're the press secretary to the president of the United States and they ask if the president has confidence in his attorney general, you say yes. Even if you know that may not be the case forever and may not have always been the case, you say yes. Because if you do not say yes, you have just made a major news story by suggesting very strongly the president does not have such confidence. And by saying, I haven't had that conversation with him, it sounds like an obvious dodge. And that's the way it has played for almost 24 hours.
Reed, do you think this has anything to do with the president's tweets about the ban that came out earlier this week?
Yes.
The travel ban?
I think it certainly does. We know that the president has been frustrated with Jeff Sessions, which is remarkable, by the way, because Sessions was essentially the only U.S. senator who backed Trump during the early part of the primary campaign, when Trump was at his Trumpiest and insulting people left and right and blowing up the political system, when all the rest of the Republican Party was treating him wouldn't touch him with a 10-foot pole. Sessions embraced him, and now Sessions is, one of Trump's closest allies, apparently does not have the confidence of the president. And by the way, I'd point out that the last few times that Sean Spicer, the White House press secretary, said that the president had confidence in a member of his administration, it was Michael Flynn right before he got fired. And then it was James Comey right before he got fired. So there's a reason that Sean Spicer is treading carefully here, because the president of the United States does not necessarily tell his own staff everything that he's thinking. And I think you can even point to what happened this morning with him announcing that Christopher Wray will be his nominee to head the FBI before the White House was apparently ready to announce that themselves.
Ron, because I'm a nerd, I actually wrote down the four tweets that the president had about this travel ban. That's what he's calling it now. At 6:20, here we go. 6:25, he tweets, people, the lawyers and courts will call it whatever they want, but I'm calling it what we need and what it is, a travel ban. 629, the Justice Department should have stayed with the original travel ban, not the watered-down PC version that they submitted to the Supreme Court. 637, the Justice Department should have asked for an expedited hearing to seek a tougher version. 644, basically saying the courts are slow and political. Those tweets seem to be aimed at the Justice Department and perhaps aimed at Sessions himself.
It was a bad breakfast at the Sessions home, and it just kept on getting worse.
Yeah.
He was criticizing the Justice Department, then he was criticizing the Supreme Court. It's just really hard to imagine how he could have made life more difficult for Jeff Sessions. Mm-hmm. And it has been reported, we have not at NPR separately confirmed, but it has been reported that at moments in this tense time, the Attorney General has either offered or at least considered offering his resignation because of the way the president is making it impossible for him to do his job or the Justice Department to do its job, or a very specific office called the Office of the Solicitor General to do its job. And that's the office where the lawyers emerge from to actually argue a case before the Supreme Court. And they are about to argue this travel ban case, we'll use the president's phrase, before the Supreme Court.
But, Ron, wasn't it the president who basically signed off on the more, as he described, PC watered-down version?
Yes, he signed off on it, but clearly he didn't love it. And he would just as soon, what's the old expression? He'd just as soon be hung for stealing sheep as for stealing goats. If he's going to lose in court, he'd rather lose with his original tough order that seems to have emerged from presidential advisor Steve Bannon way back in January, just in the early days after the inauguration day. That was the order of their heart. They wanted to disrupt the whole process by which people enter this country, even if they're re-entering with green cards and full legal rights to be in the United States. That's really what they wanted. That was the punch that they wanted to deliver. And when they backed off on that, then they felt they were fighting for half measures and their heart was really in the original order.
Reed, let me read a tweet from George Conway, happens to be married to Kellyanne Conway. He's talking about these tweets. He says, these tweets may make some people feel better, but they certainly won't help the Office of Solicitor General to get 5 votes in the Supreme Court, which is what actually matters. And then he ends sad. What do you make of that, Reed?
Well, that's because a lot of the lower courts that have blocked the travel ban have relied on the president's statements, whether it was on the campaign trail, calling for a full and complete Muslim ban, to some of the early things that he said while president-elect. They backed off calling this a Muslim ban when the order actually came out. But the fact is, the president keeps saying that it's a travel ban. It is a ban on specific people, and the courts say that is not constitutional. One of the important clips that you played earlier in the hour was of Sean Spicer saying these are the official statements of the President of the United States, and I think that's what George Conway was talking about. His words matter when it comes to the legal decisions, when it comes to the court fights that are going on right now. He is making it remarkably more difficult for his own administration to make the case that this is not, in fact, an unconstitutional ban on a specific set of people.
We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation with Reed Wilson and Ron Elving. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We are catching up on White House and congressional news in the last couple of days, talking with Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill, and with Ron Elving, senior editor and correspondent for the Washington Desk for NPR. And to join our conversation, you can text or call our comment line 267-405-2006. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Well, as we all know, James Comey will be testifying tomorrow before the Senate Intelligence Committee. Let me play an ad that's been playing, and it's from the Great America Alliance.
As head of the FBI, James Comey put politics over protecting America. After the FBI banned terms like radical Islam for political correctness, Comey allowed the dangerous practice to continue. When terror attacks were on the rise last year, Comey was consumed with election meddling, and after he testified before the U.S. Senate, Comey's own staff admitted some of his answers were flat-out wrong. James Comey. just another D.C. insider, only in it for himself. Paid for by Great America Alliance.
First of all, Ron, do we know who this is, Greater America Alliance?
Well, I think we can probably take a certain amount of information just from the name itself, Greater America, Make America Great, that sort of thing. Obviously, it's a group of supporters of the president. That is not to say that there's anything wrong with their being supporters of the president or for them to be weighing in on this controversy. This is 100% their right to do, and I expect that there will be other groups, perhaps a little better known groups or other groups with Republican ties that we're more familiar with, who will also weigh in. This particular ad has a rather hurried feel.
Yes, it does.
And does not, and I've watched the ad, it does not seem to have quite the impact that one would wish to have if one were putting a lot of money behind it in terms of time buying.
But you think, is it unusual to have an ad, obviously critical of someone who's going to testify before a Senate Intelligence Committee the day before?
Yes, it's unusual. Everything is unusual these days. It's unusual to have a fired FBI director. The only other time that has ever happened was a very different set of circumstances having to do with an ethics matter back in the early 1990s, and the departure of the FBI director at that time was widely anticipated. Anyway, it was almost a formality. It's very unusual to have a fired FBI director. Number two, it's unusual to have him coming in to testify about the circumstances of his firing. And then, of course, to have a president who communicates in the ways that he does. And we are expecting at this point that the president will be tweeting during Comey's testimony on Thursday. That is extraordinarily unusual. And so one would expect that there would be something on television in the way of a paid ad that would be unusual as well.
Reed, let me get you back in on the conversation. What do you expect from Comey? And I wonder if there are raised expectations about what he will say. Obviously, there's a FBI criminal investigation. The House and Senate also doing a kind of a fact-finding investigation into Russian alleged meddling in our election last year. But what do you expect Comey to say?
Well, we know that he is not likely to accuse the president of having obstructed the investigation. That's something that some news outlets were reporting last night. But he's likely to detail the conversations that he had with the president and specifically the memos that he wrote after those conversations took place. James Comey is a very experienced at testifying before Congress. And as a matter of fact, the committee that he will be testifying before, he essentially chose it from about four different committees that were trying to get his testimony because he has better relations and is able to is more comfortable testifying before the Senate Intelligence Committee. When he does, though, I mean, going back to that ad, I just think that's so remarkable that somebody who has no defense when a Supreme Court nominee is up, it is not uncommon for supporters and opponents to run advertising on cable news. But that's because there are supporters and opponents. In this case, you know, there's no supporter coming to Comey's aid to spend a lot of money on a television ad. It is remarkable to me that a public servant is the target of this kind of political advertising when he has never set foot in the sort of running for office arena. But Comey is, again, remarkably experienced at testifying before these committees. He's also laid a lot of groundwork. We've seen a lot of reports from Comey's friends, including some who have gone on the record to detail their conversations with him. That tells me that he has prepared for this. He knows exactly what he's going to say, exactly what he wants to say. And, by the way, he has cleared all of this with special counsel Robert Mueller, his predecessor at the FBI.
Ron, does he have some splaining to do about sort of why, if what he says is true, that the president wanted him to stop his investigation or the FBI investigation into Michael Flynn, the former national security advisor, why he wasn't more public or overt about that allegation?
Yes. And the Republican senators on the committee are going to walk him through that and are going to do it again and again and again. There will probably be several who weigh in on that question. I believe they will also throw back at him the testimony he gave in early May to the Senate Judiciary Committee, another one of the panels that, as Reed mentioned, has been pursuing testimony from Jim Comey. Senate Judiciary Committee did have him in a little over a month ago, and they asked him about whether or not anybody had been pressuring him at the Justice Department to, for some political reason, close down any kind of an investigation. Were you ever asked to shut down an investigation for political purposes by someone at the Justice Department? Mm-hmm. And he said, not in my experience. Now, that "not in my experience" quotation has appeared widely in some of the media, and particularly in organizations that support President Trump. And it's going to be thrown back at him at the hearings tomorrow, and it'll be interesting to see how he handles it. It's not hard to imagine different ways that he might respond, but let's let him respond for himself.
An email from Fred. He says, weird. Are Trump's tweets creating solid evidence for his eventual indictment? And Reid, I think probably one of the hardest jobs someone right now would be the lawyer to our president. But are the tweets, and we'll get into some other tweets down the pike, but are they going to create problems for him, especially if he's tweeting during Comey's testimony tomorrow?
You know, it's funny. There's a bar near my house that says that they will buy a round of drinks for patrons every time Trump tweets about Comey. And so if anybody's interested in real estate, presumably they'll be out of business by the end of tomorrow. But the tweets have already cost President Trump. He has, I mean, the travel ban itself has been held up in court by his, because of his language. That's something that the courts have cited as they've struck it down. And the White House lawyer, the president's lawyer, Don McGahn, has had a very rocky time in the first couple of months trying to defend a client who would much rather go out and speak for himself. There are, you know, there was this concept a few weeks ago that the White House was going to start up a war room and essentially refer every question about the Russia investigation or any of the subsequent problems that arose to that war room. That idea has apparently been scrapped. It's something that sort of modeled on what Bill Clinton's administration did during the impeachment hearings. That model, though, has been scrapped, and now these questions are dominating the White House. They're dominating the president's agenda, and they have for his first 5 months in office.
Ron, do you know what the mood is in the White House these days?
You would have to say that the mood in the White House is one of apprehension. They are afraid of what these hearings might create. They are seriously worried about the next shoe that could drop and what other investigations might be going on. And they do know that there are several others going on. But I think the greatest source of apprehension is just what's going to be in tomorrow morning's tweet storm. And what is that going to mean for the lineup of relative power between, say, a Steve Bannon, whom I mentioned earlier, a close advisor to the president, who several weeks ago the palace intrigue had him out the door. He was leaving. He was going to possibly take over the Heritage Foundation. He was going to do this. He was going to do that. Now he seems to be back as strong, as powerful, as influential with the president as ever. He is largely credited with the president's decision with respect to the Paris Climate Accord. And he may very well be driving the train at this point. He may be the operative war room, if you will, in the absence of something of that nature. And then, of course, we have questions raised about Jared Kushner, the son-in-law of the president, who had been seen as the most important person in the White House for a number of weeks. The president actually made a joke about that yesterday in meeting with congressional leaders, said his son-in-law was getting to be more famous than he was. Everyone had a good laugh, but a somewhat nervous laugh. So it is an environment of mutual suspicion, distrust, and a general feeling that bad things are coming, and one can't begin to imagine where it's all going to end.
This is sort of in the weeds here, but Reid, apparently the president had said similar things about James Comey about getting more attention. Should the president's son-in-law be worried that he's getting more attention than his father-in-law?
Yeah, boy, that sure sounds like something that has emerged as a pattern. Every time somebody becomes more famous than the president, and by the way, let's also say more famous than the president in the president's own mind. He's obviously the president of the United States, but you know, every time somebody starts getting a lot of attention, boy, they sure get smacked down real quick. I was remembering the early days of the Bush administration and the early days of the Obama administration as sort of a a corollary to this and or a contrast to what we've been seeing. And it struck me that the leaks coming out of those White Houses were all about who was claiming credit for what. The Obama folks wanted to claim credit. You know, they were sort of there was internal staff fighting over who got credit for what parts of the stimulus bill, over who got credit for what parts of the emerging health care legislation that eventually passed a few years later. In the Bush administration, it was all about tax cuts and how they brought Ted Kennedy to the table to talk about education reform. And now this White House, the leaks are all about who's up, who's down, and who's got a knife in their back.
Wow. That's Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill. Also with us, Ron Elving, senior editor and correspondent for the Washington Desk for NPR. And we are talking about the White House. We're talking about the Comey testimony tomorrow. I'm looking at my TV. Intelligence chiefs are testifying amid new Trump FBI probe claims. Much to talk about. And you can join our conversation. You can call us or text us 267-405-2006. Radio Times at WHYY.org and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. In fact, a tweet from James says, a good question is, what sort of person would accept a job in light of the former director testifying in Congress tomorrow? And this, Ron, is getting back to the fact that the president tweeted that he has named someone that he wants to head up the FBI, a man named Christopher Wray, and our listener is saying, no, who would take this job knowing that you could end up testifying before Congress?
Well, not Joe Lieberman, who was the former senator from Connecticut, who was once the vice presidential nominee of the Democratic Party in 2000, but in 2008 backed John McCain over Barack Obama, so has had occasion to be somewhat at odds with different political parties, all political parties, and yet was seen as perhaps a little too political in just that respect when his name first came up for FBI director, and he was in some respects regarded as the number one choice. But he took his name out of consideration, possibly after deciding he didn't want it, possibly after deciding he wasn't going to be offered it. Another man, John Pistol, who had been high up in the Justice Department, an important person that had headed up the Transportation Security Agency, had gone on to be president of Anderson University in Indiana. He apparently took his name out of consideration. We don't really know how many people may have been offered the job or at least tentatively offered the job, but it certainly has become a more problematic sort of plum than it might have been at one time.
Making it difficult, Reed, for the president and I guess his staff to fill positions. Also, the attorneys general, the U.S. attorneys, either fired or left, and leaving gigantic holes in part of our justice system. Is that a problem, do you think?
It's a huge problem. Look, there's this class of professional Democrats and professional Republicans who tend to move into and out of successive presidential administrations. You know, the people who take the number seven job at the Interior Department or something like that, who spend their time at think tanks or law firms in between when the other party controls the White House. In this case, though, there are a huge number of that class of professional Republicans who either were on somebody else's team during the 2016 campaign or were openly critical of President Trump as either a candidate or as president. And those people are now either reluctant to take a job in an administration that already has a special counsel investigating it, or they have been vetoed by the president himself. Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State's pick for the number two position, was a guy named Elliot Cohen, who has been a longtime Republican foreign policy expert who would have been ideally qualified for the job. The president vetoed him as a pick because he had been critical of the president as well. So there's a smaller pool from which the president has to choose. And as a new administration that doesn't really have a lot of experience governing, they don't really have a process in place, it seems, to pick a lot of these people for the sort of sub-cabinet positions, which end up being really important. And that's how government policy gets done in a lot of cases, especially at a time when Congress is so mired in gridlock. So this is a big problem for him, not just at the Justice Department, where you mentioned those 93 U.S. attorneys who were out of jobs after the new administration came into office, but also for any of the executive agencies, any of the cabinet agencies, where President Obama or President Trump wants to promulgate some of his new proposals, some of his new ideas. There just aren't the staff there to actually do it. And those people, it's not, you know, Trump likes to blame the Senate Democrats for being obstructionist. The fact is, these people haven't even been nominated. They haven't even been named. They're sort of the three-step process, naming somebody, formally nominating somebody, and then a confirmation process. They haven't even gotten to step one yet.
Well, Ron, you want to weigh in on that? And I'm also thinking about the Department of State. I know the, I believe it's the acting ambassador, a high-level person in China, basically said, I can't stand behind the president and basically quit. How much of a problem do you think this is, even internationally?
It is a large problem. It's a huge problem internationally. People are wondering who the United States is in personnel terms, who speaks for the United States. And that's the downside of it. But let's state the case and put the other side to the dilemma, which is if you are going to come to Washington as the president who does not have ties to what has gone on in the past, and if you're going to come and, quote, drain the swamp, DWS, still a great chanting line at Trump rallies, still a major theme of the Trump presidency, you're going to run into a problem trying to staff your administration, because so many of the people who are qualified and who have worked hard to earn those positions and might have some preparation for those positions are going to be people with ties to the way things used to be. And in fact, they are, if you will, the former alligators of the swamp.
That is Ron Elving, a very familiar voice to people here at WHYY, senior editor and correspondent for the Washington desk for NPR. Reed Wilson joining us as well. He's national correspondent for The Hill. And we are catching up on some news, and it seems almost every day there's a fire hose of news that we are trying to stay ahead of. And again, you can join our conversation, text or call our comment line, 267-405-2006. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Ron Elving and with Reed Wilson. We've been covering some of the news of the week. This was supposed to be a big week for the Trump administration, unveiling plans to address the nation's ailing infrastructure, something that we covered yesterday on Radio Times. We've been talking about some of the latest revelations about the Russia investigation, the president's tweets, the mood in the White House, and of course, what to expect tomorrow when former FBI Director James Comey testifies before the Senate Intelligence Committee. And again, you can join our conversation, 267-405-2006, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Reed, I'm assuming all presidents who all have big egos, you know, demand loyalty, want loyalty from the people who work for them, find it hard to admit when they've made a mistake or even to apologize. It's hard for all of us to do things like that. Is there something, though, unique about this White House when it comes to that?
What I think is unique is the lack of government experience that the president entered office with. You know, he is the first president in, oh gosh, Ron will help me on this, but you know, a century or more who did not have government experience when he came into office, and that is that appears to be obvious. I mean, you know, President George W. Bush, President Obama, in both cases had been in government, and were sort of aware of not only how government worked, but also to whom these officials were actually supposed to be loyal. When, you know, James Comey swore an oath to head the FBI, he didn't pledge to be loyal to the President of the United States. He pledged to be loyal to the United States and the Constitution, which supersede the President. And that is, you know, something that's different from the business world where you're sort of must be, at least in the Trump organization, where you have to be loyal to the person who's running the show. I think that's the biggest difference, and that is what made Comey so uncomfortable with President Trump in the first place when Trump asked for his loyalty. That's not what the FBI director is. It's not what the FBI director is supposed to do, and that has been the genesis of a lot of these issues and problems that the president's facing right now.
Ron, do you think it's inexperience? I've interviewed a number of people who covered businessman Donald Trump, and it seems, you know, the way he has run the Trump organization reminds me a little bit about how the White House is being run.
Yes, it does. And when you consider that someone 70 years of age comes to an office that he feels quite flattered and honored to have won and also quite entitled to, that person is not likely to radically change the way he has done things to be a success in business, to be a success in life in his own terms. And so when you consider that he, as Reed was saying, lacks the experience in government, and he is in fact the first president we've ever had who had neither government experience nor military experience. So you had somebody like Dwight Eisenhower, who came to the office without having been in politics, but who had been the leader of large governmental organizations, such as the Alliance of World War II that won the war in Europe. So he was somebody who had done a lot of political organizing and understood the difference between personal loyalty and national loyalties. He was someone who could come to the office of presidents and be much more prepared for it, even though he had not been a senator or a governor of some kind.
Well, I sometimes hear, Ron, people saying, you know, if only the president this, if only the president that. And as Reed said, you know, a 70-year-old, I'm not far from that, so I know how hard it is to change one's ways after you've lived a long time in this world. You know, whether a 70-year-old, I hate to be so totally ageist here, can change their spots.
It's not that easy. It's really not the natural inclination of people of a certain age to reject the way they have done things, to say, you know what, I've been wrong all along. And maybe there's a certain kind of personality that has a lot of self-examination that might be willing to do that. Surely some people have been forced to do that by issues of health or issues of law. But up to now, Donald Trump has had things pretty much his own way. He's had a great deal of confirmation. The last year has convinced him that he's right about just about everything. And so right now, he thinks something must be wrong with somebody else. And so he's looking around to find that somebody else.
Well, and Reed, and this happens when we do programs about President Trump. I mean, certainly his voters have largely stayed in support of him. And they seem to be holding firm on the president. They don't like it when the press and others criticize him.
Well, his voters, I don't think that's entirely true. So he received, what, 47% of the vote, 48% of the vote in November. His approval rating is not 47-48%. It's somewhere down in the mid 30s, and that tells me that his core supporters remain with him, but core supporters remain with everybody, even during the darkest times, especially now that we've become an increasingly partisan world in which even the director of the FBI is subject to political attack ads. So, you know, yeah, his core base is there, but they're there because they, just like the president, believe that everybody's out to get him. You know, if the election were run again today, a 35% approval rating is not enough to win re-election. As a matter of fact, no president has won re-election with anything below, you know, the high 40s. So President Trump has been bleeding support for a very long time. He keeps going back to his base to talk to the very core supporters, but at some point, you've got to reach beyond those core supporters in order to build political capital, not only for a re-election campaign, but even simply to get an agenda done in Washington, D.C. You know, I talked about President Bush and President Obama, who spent their first couple of months reaching out to the other party. President Bush with Ted Kennedy, President Obama got 3 votes, including Arlen Specter from Pennsylvania, on the stimulus bill. You know, they made real efforts to reach to the other side. President Trump has done none of that. And even this week, as he focuses on his infrastructure, tries to focus on his infrastructure plan, this trillion-dollar plan has now become a $200 billion plan, and the other $800 billion is going to be public-private partnerships. That's not a way to win over Democratic votes. You know, I've talked to a few Democratic members on Capitol Hill who tell me that the White House has not reached out to them about their infrastructure or investment needs. You know, this White House is simply not doing the job that it needs to reach beyond the president's very core support. And even that core support, can it sustain 3-4 years of this? I'm not entirely certain it can.
Ron, an email from a listener wanting to know if the guest thing you or Reid, is it possible that Trump and his staff will be cleared of all wrongdoings? And it's probably too early to know because there's so much that we don't know about what has been part of an investigation.
Absolutely. There's always that possibility, and one would have to say it's a very good possibility at this point that from a legal standpoint, no one in the White House may have broken the law. Certainly the president may not have broken any law that he can be held responsible for. And so all of this could, in some sense or another, devolve to being a problem for other people, or at least not a legal problem for the White House or for anyone in the White House. But then, of course, the other great question, and it is certainly an important one for the rest of the country, is what it does to the political standing of the White House and the president in particular, what it does to the president's agenda, the extraordinary distraction that it must be. It's not just a media obsession. It's a legal matter. It has to make its way through the legal system, and it has to make its way through Congress and all the other things that Congress needs to do get kind of set to one side, maybe shunted to one side a little bit due to this distraction. So even if ultimately there is no legal exposure, the political fallout, the legislative fallout, the reality fallout is considerable.
Let me read an email from Bernie. I'm not sure I can get through all of it, but he says, do you think fired FBI Director Comey will be asked any of the questions about his thoughts on Jared Kushner's reportedly asking Russian Ambassador Kislyak about setting up a secure telephone channel for him and members of the Trump administration, a kind of workaround when it came to intelligence? This was back in December. Do you think that'll come up tomorrow, Reid?
I doubt it would come up in an in a hearing that revolves around Comey. Comey's going to know exactly what he wants to say, what news he wants to make when he walks into that committee room tomorrow. And the Kushner relationship with Ambassador Kislyak and with some other Russian officials, that falls a little bit outside the scope of it falls a little bit outside the scope of what the FBI is investigating, and yet it's also a part of the larger ongoing investigation. And what I think you can pretty well bet on is that Comey will not say anything about the details of any investigation itself. I think he knows well enough to steer away from discussing an ongoing investigation that does not include the stuff that the senators are really going to want to talk about anyway.
Ron, is there a danger of all these investigations or people even testifying stepping on each other's toes?
Yes, absolutely. That always seems to happen whenever you have multiple investigations going on. Iran-Contra in 1987, you finally had a committee granting Oliver North, the colonel, a chance to testify with immunity, rather, so that he could say what he wanted to say and not be prosecuted on that basis. That certainly caused a lot of people to pull their hair out and say, well, wait a minute, he may have committed some actual crimes here. We need to have the freedom to prosecute him. But that had already been obviated by his immunity agreement. We know that Michael Flynn has sought similar immunity before testifying to Congress. It has not been offered.
Let me read an email from Gregory. He says, does anyone have anything even slightly positive to say about Trump? Surely he has at least some good qualities or merits. I question a news program that rarely has anything even remotely optimistic about our president. I think I'm the news program that he's referring to. I think certainly his nominee for the Supreme Court, I don't know if you'd agree with this, Reid or Ron or not, this seemed like a nominee that a Republican president would want sitting on the U.S. Supreme Court. Reid, are people too critical of the president?
I mean, that's kind of our job, is to take a look at what is actually happening in the White House and deliver the news. And the news is the FBI director has been fired and is now going to testify about conversations that he had with the president. The president himself is trying to, but by the way, the president himself is engaging and has suggested that he could essentially live tweet the Comey hearing. One can imagine that the president's staff will be diving between him and his phone if he thinks about that tomorrow. But even as the president turns to an infrastructure plan, there is no plan. There's no bill. Tax reform, there's no bill. Health care, there's no bill. The Senate is still negotiating on that. And that will be, even Mitch McConnell has said he's not entirely certain how to get to 50 votes on that. So I don't think it's a matter of being positive or negative. I don't wake up every day trying to be either one. But this is the news, and this is what is actually going on. The FBI director will testify before Congress, and he's going to be asked about conversations that made him uncomfortable with the president of the United States.
Do you want to answer that, Ron?
Every news program that focuses on the actual events in Washington, D.C. is going to seem to be a critical news program because that is, as Reed said, our job. At the same time, if you want to seek it out, there is a great deal of material out there in the media writ large, certainly including the social media, that is much more positive, perhaps, than what I would describe as objective reporting. And it takes it as its mission to find the most positive thing to say on a daily basis about the president's administration, about what he's trying to do to defend the president. And that is certainly out there and freely available in the media space.
Let me throw something else out here, and I'll toss this back to you, Ron. This is a woman named Reality Lee Winner. She was a worked for the National Security Agency and apparently reportedly gave information about Russian meddling, gave it to The Intercept. There is a lot of leaking going on in the last couple of months. Ron, what do we need to know about this case?
Well, Reality Winner is a very young woman who has served in the military and apparently got a certain amount of skill and training with respect to various kinds of intelligence gathering. And she went to work for a contractor, which has a contract with the National Security Agency. And at some point or another, this gave her access to documents, shades of Edward Snowden. I don't want to equate the cases by any means, but shades of someone who worked as a contractor and eventually was able to get access to material that perhaps they weren't supposed to see. And this may have been the case. We don't know all the facts about Reality Winner as yet, except that she felt motivated by what appears from some of her tweeting to be some degree of opposition or even animus against the president to look for things, look for documents that showed that there was some sort of Russian interference or a Russian effort to interfere, not only in the propaganda elements of last year's campaign, but even to get involved in the guts of the election process leading up to Election Day. Not to actually change votes or anything like that, but to mess with the process enough to cast doubt on the legitimacy of an American election.
Reed, a minute before we have to say goodbye, is this a particularly leaky time?
Well, I think it is. It is a leaky time, as I mentioned earlier, because the White House is sort of trying to find its way in this new world in a position in which they have really not a lot of experience. The thing that worries me, though, is that we're getting into sort of a changing of the subject by criticizing the leaks and focusing on the leak investigation rather than the actual issue brought up by the leak, which is, as Ron says, a foreign actor actually trying to undermine the legitimacy of American democracy, which is the long-term threat that we face, that underlying all of this, underlying the Comey investigation, underlying what the FBI is doing, what the CIA and the NSA are doing, that's the basis of all this, that the Russians tried to influence our actual elections and undermine the democratic process. It all comes back to that at the very beginning, and that is the true long-term threat that we face as a country.
Well, I'm going to end on that note. Reed Wilson, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
You got it. Thanks, Marty.
National correspondent for The Hill, Ron Elving, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Senior editor and correspondent for the Washington Desk for NPR. He joined us from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. Download a podcast. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Sign up for our newsletter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.